Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of KPCW. Many dentists provide a variety of services to include braces and can fix minor issues with tooth alignment. However, orthodontists have 2 more years of a full-time residency limited to growth and tooth alignment. Information about us is available at m2ortho.com.
And good morning. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. Big thank you to our sponsor this year, Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience at markmillersubaru.com. I'm Leslie Thatcher, and joining me in the studio today, my co-host, Barbara Bretz, one of our Friday film reviewers, and also a publisher of a daily Sundancer.
Which I'm running about 5 movies behind right now, I'll catch up.
Well, thanks for being here. Sure. Let's see. Let's talk about, maybe just some of your favorites.
You know, I have to start in on the light and funny ones because we all tend to overdose a little bit on the dark and weird sometimes at Sundance. But we saw a movie earlier this week that was just delightful. It's called Sing Street, and it's from the same writer, that gave us Once and Begin Again. It's kind of autobiographical about him growing up in Ireland, and it's just wonderful about a bunch of schoolboys who form a band, and they're influenced by the band and band videos of the 1980s, and so they sort of transform from one look to another look, and the music is great, and the talent is fun. So that was really a great story, and we loved laughing along with that one.
Yeah, I know one of Trevor Gross, programming director's favorite as well.
It will be out there for sure. Another one that was really funny and enjoyable was Love and Friendship, and that's the period piece, sort of a few years earlier than Downton Abbey, you know, very appropriately British, but very hysterical, and just the evil, manipulating, beautiful woman that's cruising from house to house, estate to estate back in the day, wreaking havoc wherever she goes. And it was very well received. And I think it's been purchased as well. And then one we saw last night called The Intervention, which I think the best way to describe that is kind of a new millennium big chill, and a group of friends all gather at this beautiful setting in Savannah for an intervention that one of them feels is necessary with one of the couples who just aren't getting along. And as the day wears on, you realize that it perhaps is more than just one couple who might benefit from intervention. And so there's a lot of comedic and some touching human dynamics that go on during the weekend, but we really enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, so are these all dramatic and all part of the competition or premieres here?
You know, I'm not sure that they're all in competition. I didn't write down what category they came from. We've just sort of been going in and out that revolving door at Eccles, and one kind of blends into the other. Another one that was really good was called Other People, and that director is a Saturday Night Live director, and also starred Molly Shannon, who did a great job last year in Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, but this year she's the dying girl. She's a mom with cancer, and so we kind of live through her last year, and the movie begins and ends with her deathbed scene. And just like a lot of Sundance movies, you just can't believe you're going to be watching about a movie about death and cancer, and you end up laughing as much as you do. But they did a great job with that.
So you really like to stick with the dramatic film, some?
We did, but I mean, that doesn't mean they've all been light and funny. I was there for Manchester by the Sea, who was the same director that gave us You Can Count on Me a few years ago. And that was excruciating to sit through, but not because it was bad. It was just so well acted, and there's a lot of deep depression and some issues that the main character, Casey Affleck, is dealing with. And as the director said at the end, he said, you know, I can't even get my head around what it would take to live and go on living after experiencing the tragedy that you find out has affected Casey Affleck. But he said thousands of people do it every day, and I think they deserve to have a movie made about them. So it was quite heavy, but really well acted and very well done.
I think that one was purchased as well.
I believe so. And then, of course, the big buzz is the sale that happened yesterday or the day before with Birth of a Nation. And I was at that premiere, and that you knew you were watching something big. And I really had to remind myself that this is the first directorial debut of this young actor who starred in it, screenwrote it, and directed it. I noticed Mel Gibson was listed in the credits at the end as people to thank, and I'm sure that maybe he consulted with him about the process he went through when he did Braveheart and, you know, some of the other films that he's been involved in. But it was really an awesome film, very well done. And it's also been interesting to hear some of the talk or the chatter between press people, because a few of the press snobs might have said, oh, you know, it was overly dramatic, it was over the top, it was unnecessarily brutal. And they had some critique of it that I don't think the majority of us really agreed with, and I don't think John Q. Public will agree with that either. I think they'll all be pretty amazed with the talent and the cast and several standing ovations during the film.
Yeah, there was a segment on Morning Edition this morning about the purchase, like 17.5 million,
big-time record for Sundance.
Yep. Well, we're going to get to our first guest. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. Stay tuned.
Josh Carr here, membership director at Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of KPCW. Park Meadows offers an 18-hole Jack Nicklaus golf course, weekly ski groups, on-mountain club including parking and locker room at Chateau Deer Valley, cross-country skiing, fine dining, and fitness center. Golf and social memberships available at 649-2460 or on the web.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Being a member of the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business and provides a wide array of benefits. We promote your business, provide networking and educational opportunities, and even have benefit programs for you and your employees. For more information, visit us online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW Radio. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host, Barbara Bretz. Well, in one of the most polarizing issues of today, documentary Stephanie Sotig takes this year on the issue of guns and gun violence in her new film, Under the Gun. The film is being featured in this year's documentary premiere category. She joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So the write-up in this year's film guide says that you have created a documentary that is, quote, scrupulously comprehensive and decidedly fair to both sides on one of the most polarizing issues that's tearing our country apart. So as a journalist, I love to hear those words, you know, just scrupulously fair. I mean, the way that I judge fair when a balanced story is that most people, you know, that both sides are angry with me. I mean, how does that account sound to you?
Well, I think what's fair about it is we embedded with several families across the country, both parents who have lost children to gun violence and a family who thinks that the best way to protect her baby is to open carry. So she has her baby on a baby board in the front and an AK-47 on her back. And so I think that that's perhaps what they consider fair, is because we let you hear from both sides of the argument.
Mm-hmm. You've teamed up once again with Katie Couric, of course, the longtime news anchor of CBS and NBC. I mean, was she the one always like looking over your shoulder to create that fairness, or how, I mean, what was her role in this?
So the film was actually her idea. She called me after Isla Vista. We were making Fed Up when Newtown happened. So we had, and I'm from Brookfield, Connecticut. So I'm in the town that's right next to Newtown. So we spoke at length about Newtown. And then she called me after Isla Vista, and she's like, how does this keep happening? And how is it that 90% of the country supports stronger background checks, and yet nothing's happening? How is Congress so out of sync with the majority? I mean, 90% of people don't even like kittens. So it feels like a real disconnect is happening in this country.
Well, and that was certainly one of my questions. Nothing has happened. Why? I mean, does...
I wondered, too, and Stephanie, I had a moment to talk about this before. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, we grew up in the generation that at least got the warning label put on cigarette packages and ads removed from TV and magazines. And what's different, you know, now between back then when we were experiencing some success?
So what we learned in making the film is actually that so much has happened since Newtown. And I don't know why we all think nothing's happened since Newtown. So much has happened. Almost every state across the country has passed legislation since Newtown. Unfortunately, the majority of those ease guns restrictions, make it easier to have access to guns. But so much has happened. And so many positive things have happened, though, too. There's been a real people's movement that's happened. There really is a Newtown effect that's occurred. And we're seeing that, you know, people are taking this on at the state level. And then you see Moms Demand Action. A woman started a Facebook page and suddenly they have 3.5 million followers. So I think what to me is most exciting about the film is we have so many misconceptions about this, from this idea that nothing's happened to how this idea that people want to take away your guns. And the film really unpacks all of that in a way I think that's really interesting, because you're seeing it through these characters' eyes. So it's very character driven, and it unfolds sort of like a whodunit. And I'm just really excited to share it with people.
It really does have, I did get to preview this, and it really does have a mixed bag of presenting so many wonderful facts and figures and sound bites that I continued to quote all through the day as I ran into people. But also it really adds a personal touch and a face by interviewing and bringing in some of these families who've been touched by gun violence and who have become some of the best activists.
It's true. I mean, I think if this happened to me, I think I would, if I had lost a child the way they had so violently, I probably would have crawled into a hole. And so to see them pick themselves up by the bootstraps and become such warriors and be so fair, you know, the people of Newtown sit down with NRA members all the time. They've really changed the conversation. I think for so long it's been very black and white. You're with us or against us. And what these people have done is really brought to life this idea that we have more in common than we disagree about. And they're just extraordinary. And to be able to have embedded with them for nearly 2 years, you'll see so many interesting aspects of this issue that you just don't hear about in 2 minute news clips anymore.
Well, unfortunately, when I left the film, I was fired up, but I had to leave about 10 minutes before it ended. And so I wanted to ask you, what did I miss? And would I have left feeling like there's hope or an answer or common ground?
So I don't want to give away the whole end of the film, obviously. However, yes, you will feel empowered. You will feel hopeful. You will realize that up until now, the NRA and the gun lobby has really been dictating the narrative on the issue. And their narrative is very
right
false.
Down to the legislation.
Right down to the legislation. But also just the parroting that everyone does of these false facts that we've come to accept as truth. So what's actually happening at the state level, at the grassroots level, is so encouraging. The tide is turning. That's not to say that we can all sit back now and say, oh, problem solved. But there are so many things that we can do and that we should be doing and that are being done that are so hopeful.
I want a little bit more about that, though. So those on the side of restricting gun sales, I mean, like to blame the NRA. I mean, that it's the organization's fault. I mean, do we blame the NRA or do we blame the politicians who are taking the money from NRA? I mean, do you get into the funny?
I think there's plenty of blame to go around. I think down to me, right? So prior to making this film, I didn't vote with gun sense. Where a politician stood on the gun issue was not even on my radar. So I think there's a collective responsibility that we have to take. And there needs to be an awakening, because, again, like, I can't stress how much. When Katie brought this idea to me, I was like, I know about the gun debate. We all know about the gun debate. We have no idea about the gun debate. We've really been hoodwinked for the past 20, 30 years. And I think that's what's so exciting about this, is we just start peeling back the layers. And it's just so shocking to see what's really at the core of all of this.
Have you happened to see the Newtown documentary?
I haven't yet. I will be seeing it at the end of this week. I've been on a lot of panels with Kim Snyder, and I've heard great things about it.
Yeah. Does the film offer any conciliatory ideas to move each side a little bit?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think it will start a conversation. And don't forget, again, 90% of us are on the same page about this. So if that doesn't bring people to the table, I think what the film does is it advocates a conversation between people. And I also think this is a film for gun owners. Sometimes I think even more than anyone else. I've had so many gun owners come up to me and say, thank you. I've been so misrepresented by the NRA for so long.
There's such a silent majority out there.
The NRA only represents 5% of gun owners. So that 95% of gun owners that aren't belonging to the NRA have been totally unrepresented. And to have them come up and say, thank you, finally someone showing that I'm not some crazy, you know, gun zealot. And I really appreciate that. And I hope that, you know, we'll have screenings full of gun owners, because this film is just as much for them as it is for the gun safety advocates.
Well, I think, you know, anyone who takes the time to make impactful documentaries, I thank you for that. I'm also very thankful that there's so many platforms now to get them out there and be seen other than here in Sundance. So I wish you best of luck with distribution or wherever you go from here.
Thank you. It's looking very, very exciting. So I think a lot of you will be able to watch this film very soon.
That's great.
Okay. Let's see. The couple of screenings left here. We've actually just one, it looks like.
No, we have a Friday community screening, a Saturday screening, and then we're in Salt Lake City on Sunday.
Yeah. Okay. But then in terms of locally, I've got just the Temple Theater Saturday at 5:45 p.m.
Correct.
I thought going to
yes.
Salt Lake. What was the other?
We're in Salt Lake City on Sunday. And you can go to underthegunmovie.com, and we have all of our screenings on there as well.
Okay. Stephanie Sotig?
Sotig.
Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the local Sundance Reel here on KPCW. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Hi, I'm Margot Van Ness from Park City and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City offers events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City this winter at parkcitymountain.com.
And you're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. Well, it was a sad day in 2014 when the poet with the beautiful voice, Maya Angelou, passed away. In their new film, Maya Angelou and I Still Rise, directors Bob Hercules and Rita Coburn-Wax celebrate the woman, the poet, the activist. They join us now in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Well, the film attracted me just because I love listening to her recite poetry. I guess I'm not alone in that sense.
There's legions of you out there, yes. She has an amazing voice, for sure.
And there's a lot of poetry in the film. So we not only had her poetry, but we linked together her voice over the years so that she is the narrator of the film, so that you do get her story in her own voice.
Yeah. And Rita, you had met and interviewed her previously, had you not?
Yes. Well, I used to work for Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ, and I interviewed a lot of women authors, and that was the first time. Isabel Allende, Amy Tan, mm-hmm. Shauna Sink Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and of course, Maya Angelou. And that was the first time that I physically met her and interviewed her on her memoirs. And then later, I worked with Oprah Radio. And she was my host from 2016 to 2010. So I worked with her on a monthly basis, visited her home in order to cull programs for a month for the show.
Yeah. And I came late to the Maya Angelou party here. I mean, it was the 1993 inaugural speech.
Okay.
But Clinton's that it was like, oh, my, who is this woman? And what a beautiful poem.
Yeah, in fact, we have a phenomenal segment in our film about that kind of deconstructs that event. So we were able to interview President Clinton and Secretary Hillary Clinton, of course, Maya Angelou. And there's a wonderful clip on there where she's on the Charlie Rose show right after that, and she explains the poem On the Pulse of Morning. And it's great because there's a lot of information I don't think anybody knew before.
Well, and that's what was so surprising to me, seeing the film, was, you know, I just saw her as a poet, I mean, and an author, and yet she had this amazing creative life, I mean, as a singer and an actress and a dancer, well before that. I love that you showed all of that.
As a filmmaker, there are times when you run into a subject that really opens themselves to not only a documentary, But in this particular case, for whatever backgrounds we brought to the party, the various documentaries that we have done, here was someone who lived history and participated in it and then documented it herself, and then other people documented it. So what we had was this enormous wealth of information. And as you say, we could go from the 50s with her doing Calypso to her being in London on Face to Face to the inaugural. And so we had a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. And with such an astounding life, I mean, how do you choose to what to cover and what not to leave out?
And that was our biggest challenge, is how to take this enormous story and create a 2-hour film that was coherent. And so that was, I think, our biggest challenge. I think what we decided was that we would focus on a few key stories in her life at the expense of a million other things. And those would be kind of universal stories that would help tell the larger story. And so we tried to go in depth on a few things, such as the inauguration, such as this amazing piece where she was in this play, The Blacks by Jean Genet, 1960. And so you get a little more depth of those stories. And, you know, that was our strategy.
I think people will probably be moved to read the 7 books about her life, and they would get a fuller picture. But obviously, as we tracked her life, there were certain things we wanted to do, some things that were very familiar, and then we wanted to do some things that were more obscure, so that you would be led into her story. And she really led us. As we begin to excavate the story, we begin to see what needed to be told. And so it, we felt like she not only participated in interviews prior to her death,
kind of co-directed
Yes, she was there. She was very present. And having been a director herself, and she would often call us and say, how are you doing with that documentary? I'm not getting any younger. And we really respected her participation. She wanted her story told well.
Yeah, well, you did a fine job telling it. What do you think that it was important for you as filmmakers to let people know about Maya?
Well, for me, it was the story of, it was an inspiring story. It was important for us to tell her story, that the film, in a larger sense, could be an inspiring story, especially to young people, that people struggling with things could look at what she overcame and say, oh, okay, she overcame these enormous challenges. She was raped when she was 7. Mm-hmm. She was in the Jim Crow South in a vicious, racist place called Stamps, Arkansas. Yet she overcame that with grace and dignity. And so that's a lesson that I think people watching the film, especially we're hoping for young people, to watch the film and get inspired by her story.
And for you?
Well, it was very personal and professional for me, being an African-American female and a member of the DGA, and knowing that she was the first Black member of the DGA, and seeing all the struggles that still exist with women telling their stories of their cultures, and also you know, oftentimes those stories are being dismissed, and I think we have to address that. And I think we have to address the struggle of a woman finding her voice. So for me, that's universal. Women need to find their voice, and that's what she did. And in the very beginning quote, which she says, you may encounter many defeats, but you must not be defeated. In fact, it may be necessary for you to encounter defeat so that you know who you are. I think that's universal to men and women. But coming from her perspective and from me, it was very personal for me to get that voice out there.
Well, and when you say find her voice, mm-hmm. She gave up her voice for 5 years.
She became a voluntary mute when she was raped at 7. But for those 5 years, what was so interesting was she's 7 years old. She's in a South that is very classical in education. So she's reading Balzac, Guy de Maupassant, Shakespeare. From those 5 years, she reads all the books in the Black library and a lot of the ones in the white library.
So it ends up being a very enriching period for her.
And she also listens and claims her body as an ear. She comes out of that and she can do 5 languages in her life. She can speak fluently 5 languages eventually. And she's got this classical education, even though she's never had a degree from a university. She's had honorary degrees upwards of 60.
Yeah, and I was going to say her brilliance. I mean, I don't know if it was a photographic memory or, I mean, but the a brilliant woman.
That
yeah,
5 years of being a voluntary mute in the South that wanted to teach you classically, and she lived with a very biblically based grandmother. So she learned the classics, she learned the Bible, she learned some things that were so ingrained in her later that when she called on them, they infused her voice with that type of wisdom.
I didn't really, her life with men, I mean, she wasn't very successful, or maybe she thought she was very successful and that's why she moved on. It was just time to move on. Can you talk a little bit about her, or was it being raped? Was it being abandoned?
Well, we're not psychotherapists, so we don't really know the story, but she had at least three husbands that we know of. Her last husband, Paul Defer, was maybe in some ways the most successful marriage or relationship she had, but even that ended. Her son, Guy Johnson, who's in the film, who's really an amazing person in the film, and he's riveting, he talks about how that was maybe the best relationship, but even that failed, and it's kind of sad that even that didn't work out. So we don't really know. It's hard to understand why these marriages and relationships didn't work out, but she still had a joyful, incredible life. So it's not, I think people are surprised at how much humor is in the film. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of laughs in the film because she was very funny. Guy Johnson has an incredible dry sense of humor. And there's a lot of great stories that are humorous as well in the film.
Yeah, I think people will be able to personally and dissect what they can glean from that, because marriage and relationships are difficult as it is. And one of the things that she says is that she wouldn't stay in a relationship where there was no love. She was actually married formally twice. Her marriage to Vus Maki, the West African freedom fighter, was said to be a marriage, but it was more of a common law marriage. And then there are other relationships in the book. So she kept trying.
In our last few minutes, let's just talk about, I mean, what I loved, it was just endearing, her lessons on respect. Mm-hmm. You have with a young woman asking her a question and calling her Mai, and she's like, oh, no, honey.
Well, you know, but she did that all her life. Bob and I have been on the receiving end of a lesson from her, too, and most people in her presence. But I think when you look at the fact, a very important story in the front is when her grandmother is disrespected by some young white girls who essentially turn their bottoms up to her. But she has to call them Miss Elaine, Miss Carolyn, while they can call her Annie. And so throughout Maya Angelou's life, as a signal of respect, whenever I was with her, I think she slipped once or twice, and I was with her for 4 years, she would call me Mrs. Wack. I would call her doctor. The household help would be called Mrs. Chris. She did not want someone to say, hey, Brenda, come here. She always wanted the respect of what that person had to offer. And I think it was ingrained from what she saw with her grandmother. And she kept that her whole life.
Well, and then also pulling aside rapper Tupac, basically, and what a wonderful thing to say to somebody. I think this was when she said, has anybody told you that you're important today?
That you're the best we have, that we were on auction blocks for you, that we worked during the day and stayed up after the night. And that was something that, as she continued to champion young people, write a poem for Michael Jackson's death, have a relationship with Common, with Dave Chappelle. She wrote a poem for Beyonce and Jay-Z's daughter, Blue. She always wanted to stay connected to the up-and-coming generation. That was very important to her.
And I'm sure to them as well.
Oh, absolutely. She was such an inspiration to all those people as well, especially people that were artists and were writers and singers, because music was central to her life. As you saw early in the film, she had a whole career as a calypso singer, and she sang her whole life. She started interviews with us with a brief part of a song usually. I don't know if that's how she got warmed up or into the zone, but it was just wonderful.
Well, a fabulous film, and I recommend it highly. I mean, can you tell us, is it going somewhere other than festival circuit?
American Masters, and our hopeful date is sometime this fall, 2016. So American Masters.
On PBS, then, right?
On PBS.
Right. Well,
right.
Wonderful. Good. So everybody can see
it. And it shows tonight.
Yep. 6:30 at Redstone Cinema.
Right.
And then Saturday night also, 9 p.m. at the Yarrow Hotel. Those are the local theaters.
That's right.
Well, thanks for spending some time with us.
Beautiful,
thank you. Magical
so much.
Film. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank's Park City branch. We have been part of this community since 1998 as a local town bank. We take pride in giving back by supporting KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have branches in Heber City, Midway, and Park City on Deer Valley Drive. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And you're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host today, Barbara Bretz. Well, described as the Brangelina of the 1970s South Korea, the romance between film director Shin Sang-ok and a glamorous actress Choi Yoon-hee ended, as many Hollywood stories go, when fame took a toll on their love. And then it got really weird, and the studio tells more about their film, The Lover and the Despot, one of the films in this year's World Documentary Competition. I have directors Robert Cannon and Ross Adam. Good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Morning. Thank you for having us.
So is that a fair characterization of the couple, the Brangelina of the 1970s South Korea?
Yeah, I think someone here coined that just recently. But I would say yes, it's a kind of fair description.
They had comparable fame. I mean, yes, they were the biggest stars in South Korea at the time.
And Shin was not only the most prolific director, he was also a studio boss, a very powerful man. He had the biggest studio in the country at the time.
All right, so they were just living life, and then they're kidnapped?
Well, it's a little more suspenseful than that.
Yes. Well, they had a remarkable love affair that lasted for decades until Shin had an affair with a younger actress. And they split at that point, and that's when things went a bit crazy. Choi went to Hong Kong and disappeared.
Shin, who also had lost his ability to make films for various reasons, his studio had collapsed, he had no money, he still wanted to get back with his ex-wife, so he went to Hong Kong looking for her. It wasn't long before he disappeared too.
So it is a love story, a melodrama as well as like a thriller.
But as you guys were building the steps, and I did get to preview the movie, it was great. As you were building the steps, you didn't so much recreate the scenes as I think maybe used film clips from other movies to set the tone and build the backstory. Is that right?
Yeah, we actually did a little bit of both, but we felt that Shin and Choi too as well, they very much kind of lived in their movie imaginations. They were both obsessed with movies and with filmmaking, so we used clips from their films to help tell their story, and we also did recreations on Super 8, which kind of sits somewhere between the movie clips and the real archive that we found.
So Choi was the protagonist. We have a lengthy interview with her, but Shin passed away years ago, so we had no way to represent him in the film. So using film clips and using some key tape recording archive is the way we did that.
Well, and it's a true story, so I don't think I'm spoiler alerting by laying out a little bit of the plot for listeners who maybe haven't seen the story. It is true. The woman is kidnapped first and basically held captive. Her husband then is taken, with the plot of turning him or having him create propaganda films for the North. And the dictator at the time was a big film buff. And so it was his goal to sort of use them as his propaganda tools. And it also offered Shin finally an unlimited budget to do sort of the thing that he had dreamed of. So I'm sure in a way he was caught between wanting to use the director as well to realize some of his dreams.
Well, this is one of the key conflicts in the film. We, as filmmakers, as directors, were very attracted to the idea of this Faustian pact of a director who lost everything and then gained everything, but at a price. He's working with a tyrannical dictator. So that's something that personally attracted us. But one of the great things is this secret tape recording, which happened in North Korea, features a moment where Shin is actually contemplating this exact idea. Should he stay or should he go?
How can he betray the man who's given him everything?
So did you need special permissions to make this happen then? I mean, to get this secret recording? Or?
Well, no permission was requested from Kim Jong-il. This was done at great risk by Choi and Shin, recording Kim Jong-il, yeah.
And in fact, if I understood right in the movie, when they came into possession of that tape, it was the first time that the Americans or the Western or the South Koreans had actually heard his voice. I mean, their society was so secret that no one had even known what he sounded like before they had that tape.
That's right. And one thing that Shin and Choi worked out when they're in North Korea, and without giving away what actually happens later in the story, they knew that if they were to escape, particularly people in South Korea, who had a very, very hard time believing their story. You know, neither of them were able to make films. Suddenly they wind up in North Korea. They're making films for the North with, you know, bigger budgets than they have before. So they knew they needed some proof. And the only way to do that would be to record their conversations with Kim Jong-il. And as you say, no one had heard Kim's voice before.
So my question is, when they were there, it was known in South Korea that they were producing. I mean, that was part of his scheme, was to use them for propaganda, right? So it was known that they were there.
Yeah, although it did take a few years before news got out. And that's actually because they were kept separately for about 5 years. As you mentioned, Shin was put through, you know, a process of indoctrination. He was in various prisons.
For 5 years, right?
Five years. And it was only after that five-year period that Kim Jong-il surprised them beyond all belief by reuniting them at a party. Mm-hmm. And that's when he said, you're going to be my filmmakers.
So my question now is, is this story known now in South Korea? Is there still doubt among the population as to whether or not they were traitors? And will the movie be shown there?
Completely. I mean, when the news first broke, it was given a spin by the South Korean government that these two have been kidnapped, because it was a kind of propaganda story at the time. However, when they escaped, everyone in South Korea thought they had gone willingly. So they did come to the United States, and it took a number of years before the South Korean government would officially accept their story. Still today in South Korea, perhaps even more than half of the people still think they went willingly.
Well, I mean, we certainly hear strange things about his son, but it sounds like the dad just is whacked. Gosh, it's, yeah, yes. It was like news to me.
That was another interesting tidbit from the film, because you mentioned the grandfather and how he had almost been a little more socialized and outgoing and normal, if we can use that term. And then the father was a little more strange, leading me to believe that the third generation might be even worse.
Yeah. Well, I mean, imagine growing up like that. You know, you're born to be a dictator in a really bizarre regime.
Well, this is one of the things that fascinated us, and we didn't think we could tell this story without going into some of the psychology of Kim, how the conditions that created this monster, I guess.
Well, and how he must have reacted when the exciting event happens in the end, you know, how he must have reacted losing his birds in the cage, so to speak.
Well, there is an interesting fact. After Shin and Choi escaped, Kim Jong-il brought all North Koreans into halls. They were ordered to do this, and they were told that they were no longer to see Shin and Choi's films, and essentially they'd be expunged from North Korean history. So
Yeah, it's very much a taboo story now in North Korea.
Well, I hope their legacy can live on in your documentary, since it doesn't live on in North Korea.
Yes.
So you were able to, real quick, to bring the film to a Sundance Lab. I mean, what was that experience like?
Well, Sundance Labs were just a great, great time for us. We, at the point in which we invited to come, we knew that the edit would need to be like a month or two more, and we only had about 3 weeks. So Sundance came in at that point, and they gave us the time and the space and some incredibly good minds to work with us and take the film further than it was at that point. So we're incredibly appreciative to Sundance for this.
So did it change the movie? It just made it a better movie? Is that, I mean...
Well, at the point at which we came, we had received these tapes, the secret recordings. We only had one to begin with. So we edited for a while without having the rest of them. And at the point at which we received the rest of them, we started going through this. This is actually at Sundance. We realized this is just a wealth of material here to create the relationship between Shin, Choi, and Kim that we really needed to do and was lacking in the film at that point. So I think that was one of the key things that happened at Sundance.
Has she seen the movie?
We've sent it over. We only finished a movie less than 2 weeks ago. We sent it over. We know that her son has watched it, but sadly she is very ill at the moment. So he did say at the moment she's not really well enough to see it. So we're hoping that changes.
Well, the documentary filmmakers Robert Cannon and Ross Adam, directors of The Lover and the Despot, they got two more local screenings here on Thursday at 3 o'clock at Temple Theater, then again the Egyptian Theater Friday evening at 5:45 p.m. Thanks for spending time with us. Good luck with the film.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. It's 9:46.
Support for KPCW comes from the Park City Film Studios and Crandall Capital. Now open for business, the studio offers three sound stages, 45,000 square feet of meeting and event space, and dedicated truck and trailer parking, each with its own individual power hookups. Site plan, stage layout, and more at parkcityfilmstudios.com.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a not-for-profit community hospital and a proud supporter of KPCW. At Park City Medical Center, our OBGYNs use the latest surgical advances, like minimally invasive hysterectomies, endometrial ablation, and laparoscopic procedures. Even better, they also offer the convenience of having your procedure close to home. Doctors Jeannie Falk, Lorraine Sabella, and Jeremy Clark are the only OBGYNs who practice surgery and deliver right here in Park City. Make an appointment today by calling 435-658-7400.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with Barbara Bretz. Well, in what's been described as the strongest field yet for world cinema, Sandstorm, one of the films in this year's World Cinema categories. Joining us now in the studio, I have actress Lamise Amar, along with the editor Ronit Parrott of the film Sandstorm. Good morning, ladies.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So this is a film that was made in Israel?
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
In the south, in the desert.
In the desert.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about the plot of the film.
About what?
The plot.
Yes. It's about two Palestinian Bedouin women. They live in the south of Israel. And it's about their relationship between each other. They passed a lot of things.
Mother and daughter.
Mother and daughter, exactly. The mother... she is now the second wife. No, she actually, the father have now second wife. He married to another woman. And Layla, and she finds out that her daughter Layla have a relationship with another man from another village. So here the things of their relationship got complicated. And yes, I can say in one sentence that it's about women that are trying to get out of the box, and it's about a new generation that trying to be in another place, to bring his self into the culture, let's say, and Yeah, we can see in the movie that their cultural and political situation is not that good.
Although it's improving, because when the movie starts, she is with her father. She's driving the truck from school. So we already know that her father is a little bit non-traditional, and that the daughter's driving and they're having this discussion about her education. So we see that there's some potential change, and she's hopeful about that change.
Exactly.
But the mother is still... I waited the whole movie hoping your mother would smile or look not tired or be just a little bit happy. And I don't think it ever happened.
No, but there is an emotional change, I think.
There is.
In the mother way, how she treats her daughter. I mean, there is a change. Maybe she's holding herself the whole film, but there is a place where she understands that she needs to change herself in order to help her daughter to make a change her life. Yeah.
And then you sort of see this progression because you have the mother and the teenage daughter, and then there are three more younger sisters coming up in the future. So you see maybe there's hope in the future.
I just want to make a point that it's about Bedouin people are living in this desert. It's like it's quite a large group of people that live in the Israeli desert and have no electricity, have no water connection.
They actually live in unrecognized villages. Yes.
Okay.
So is that a challenge? Since I don't know, you were there though. I mean, is that, did that create a lot of challenges being filming in the desert? Or
there was a lot of challenges, of course. It was challenging to meet the people and to know their stories. We did it also before we shooted the film. We went to the desert and met the women there and speak to them, and we saw how they connect with each other and what they do with their daily life. And I think after I saw the movie before yesterday, that we did a very good job
portraying their lifestyle.
Yes, exactly, because it's a realistic movie, and I think it's the situation, their situation, and their reality is passed through the film.
So one of the themes that I noticed, or I think that I noticed or interpreted, is several times they emphasized to the father, because he would make a dictate of how something had to be, and you and your mother both at different points said, it doesn't have to be that way. You're choosing to make it be that way. So to me, that was kind of a theme that you were pointing out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I have to say, as the film editor, it's been said three times, I think, during the film. And the last time when Laila says it to her father, we weren't sure if to put it. We thought maybe it's too much, you know, for a third time. Like we might be repeating it, but then we understood that this is the point, that we must have it on the last time. She must say it again. You have to make your own choice. Don't just do whatever.
Has always been done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's a thing that we had to thought about.
So I wanted to ask you, too, this is a movie that's in Arabic but with English subtitles. And so, you know, I know that something is going to be lost in translation, literally, because it just has to be a little more simplified to have the English captions. But what would you hope that a Western audience or any audience would take away from the movie?
For me, as an artist who did a film, the most important thing is the drama story. All the rest, like the Bedouin situation, the way they feel, how they live, it's an extra. I think it's an international story, although it takes place in the desert. So whatever you take from the particular life they have, that's fine. But for me, this is also the way how we approach it, was the emotional things that are growing between these people in the family and the struggle.
And every culture has that. It just looks different.
So that's why the translation, you know, it doesn't... if you understand, you know, the main drama, that's the thing to have, to enjoy the film and have, an emotional experience.
Well, and to me, the ending was quite powerful as well.
Don't tell the ending.
I'm not going to tell the ending, but just... You know, the way you had the little sister looking on, you know, you can walk away with your feeling of hopelessness or hopefulness. You can kind of take away what you feel at that point.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we think about, you know, cultures with tradition, I mean, this is one, I think, I mean, we've got like the Eagle Huntress taking on this idea of a woman that, or a girl who can hunt with an eagle. That's a man's tradition. Sunita, you know, actually kind of at the brink there of changing tradition. In fact, that you know, we could have female rappers and stuff. So this too, I mean, is it reflective, though, of real life in terms of being on the brink of really disrupting tradition?
I didn't understand the question. Can you repeat it?
Yeah, I mean, are we very, is it in the real world out there, I mean, are we on the cusp of changing tradition? I mean, because we have all of these films that just, you know, are you know, kind of breaking the, you know, the mold, I guess.
Yeah, I think the fact that Layla is a teenager Bedouin woman and she's going to the university, it's not something that it's regular in this culture, not because the man controls the woman and he doesn't want her to go to study or something, but because they live in a place that culturally it's different than their culture. Like if they have to go to the university, they will have to speak Hebrew and they don't know how to speak.
But today more and more women go to the university.
Exactly.
So there is a change. It's a slow change. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
very
few
slow.
Years ago, yeah, much less women went to university. Much.
Yeah.
There is a change. It's not, you know, one it's point change. It's
very
it
slow
time.
Change. And we believe that it's very different than the past time.
Yeah.
So this is the film director's first feature film, yeah, my understanding. Mm-hmm. So you hadn't worked with her before then?
With Elite?
Yeah.
I hadn't worked with her before. It was my first time.
Oh, your first job? Actress, acting job?
No. I studied acting in the university in Haifa. And I'm a theater actress. Mm-hmm. It's the first feature movie I participate in.
You did a great job.
Thank you.
And I love the promo picture with you putting your hand over that guy's mouth.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, I was so happy that I have the chance to represent this woman because we came from the same nation and I thought that I can represent them in the most right way and to show really their strength and how they live. And I hope we did it. Yes, and about Elite, I enjoyed really working with her because she knew exactly what she wanted to do. And it's very comfortable for actor to feel that things from a director.
Yeah, that's right.
And we had a relationship that based on trust. It's also very important. And yeah, she knew Arabic. So I felt also that I'm here with a director, not director that from another culture definitely and he knows nothing. She really knew also Arabic, and it was very interesting to work with her.
And if I'm not mistaken, the movie has been purchased, has it not?
Yeah, to France, yeah.
What?
It was purchased to France 2 days ago, to a cinema, distribution, yes.
So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you, yeah.
Folks here in Park City will have a couple of other opportunities to see it. Friday, 1 o'clock at Redstone Cinema number 2, and then Saturday afternoon, 4 o'clock at Holiday Village. Well, thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank
Best
you very
of luck,
much.
And again, congratulations.
Thank you.
We've been talking with the actress of Sandstorm, Lamise Amour, along with editor Ronit Porat. This is the Sundance Reel on KPCW.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Also, a big thank you to our sponsor this year, Mark Miller Subaru, for joining us. Love the experience at markmillersubaru.com. So what have you got going on then for the next few days, Barb?
A couple more movies. I'm taking off a little early this year, heading up to Yellowstone on Sunday, but I've got 9 more movies on tap that I hope to get written up before I go. Looking forward to seeing Mr. Pig. Haven't heard much about it yet, but that was on my to-do list. And Jim, the documentary that I've been hearing a lot about, the Jim Foley documentary.
Yeah, that was something special.
Yeah. So... Yeah, just a lot. And I have to go back to everything Robert Redford says. It's all about the story.
All right. So what else? I mean, the nine movies, you mentioned a couple?
Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to mention a couple of others that have been purchased and some that are going to be showing up on HBO and some of the premium channels. Chelsea Does is a four-part series on drugs, marriage, technology, and racism. That sounds kind of interesting. Birth of a Nation, of course, we talked about, has been bought up. Tallulah is out on Netflix. Also, Fundamentals of Caring, which is one of the closing shows on Friday. And Love and Friendship, which is one of the fun ones that we saw earlier in the week.
Great. All right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing those. You've been listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW Park City. Barb, again, thank you.
You're welcome. It's always fun.
See you at the movies. This is Community Radio, listener-supported KPCW. It's 10 o'clock. Stay tuned now for news.